Part 2. The links. The next 6 chapters are on the links of dependent origination. Often people think dependent origination is synonymous with these links. These links are indeed very important, but as we'll see in Part 3, there's more to dependent origination than just the links. Nevertheless, it is important to have an understanding of these links, since this is the format in which dependent origination is most frequently encountered. This section will survey the various interpretations of the links and their implications. It is essential that you keep in mind that these links are not about causes, rather they are about necessary conditions. If you start trying to figure out how some link causes the next one, you will miss the actual teaching, because that is not what is being taught. Dependent origination is about dependencies. It's right there in the name. It is not about causes. Keep the basic meaning of iddapachayata in mind. This arises dependent on that. If that doesn't happen, this doesn't arise. Why do we die? I am of the nature to die. I cannot avoid death. Anguttara Nikaya 5.57. Why do we die? I don't mean heart disease or cancer or stepping in front of a bus. I mean, how come you gotta die? If you were making it up, would you make it up so that you'd have to die? I mean, think about it. You got born. That's pretty traumatic. Then you got to do the diaper thing. That's not any fun. Finally, you do start to have fun, and they ship you off to school. You do 12, 16, 24 years. You get out of school, and they put you to work. You work for 40 years, and finally, you can have some fun, and you die. Are we not doing something we should be doing? What if we hung a lot of crystals in the windows, and then... No, the New Agers already did that, and they're still dying. Maybe we're doing something we shouldn't be doing. Do you realize that over 90% of the people that ever ate food are now dead? So, maybe if we... No, that's not going to work either. One thing's for sure. If you get born, you die. If you don't get born, you don't die. It would appear that birth is a necessary condition for death. Of course, that only raises the question, why do we get born? I don't mean the gleam in your father's eye. I mean, why bother being born if you are just going to wind up dead? Being born is a popular thing to do. Everybody I know did it. In the spring, it's really popular. Birds do it. Bees do it. Birth is happening all over the place. There seems to be this urge in nature to become, to get born. And then, eventually, everything born winds up dead. This urge to become, where does it come from? From an evolutionary perspective, becoming is a successful response of individual organisms in preserving their genes. If that preserving response didn't happen, that genetic line comes to an end, and a species will die out. So what does preserving really mean? It's making something that exists continue to exist. If we take preserving out of the context of a specific species preserving response, we can generalize it. If we examine preserving from a conscious control perspective, we find that preserving means clinging to whatever has been obtained. Thus, becoming is dependent on clinging, and becoming leads to birth, which leads to death, and even other sorts of dukkha before death. So, clinging, what about this clinging? What do you cling to? Think about the things you cling to in your life. You'll notice that the things you cling to are the things you really want. Once you get the things you want to hang on to them. That's where the clinging comes from. If you don't really want it, you're not going to cling to it. If someone gives you a fruitcake for Christmas and you don't like fruitcake, are you going to cling to it? You don't really want it. You certainly weren't desiring fruitcake. Then along comes somebody else and they say, oh, wow, I love fruitcake. You want the fruitcake? Here, have the fruitcake. You're not clinging. You'll give it away really easily. But if it's something you really want, then you're going to cling to it. This really wanting, this craving leads to clinging, and clinging leads to becoming and birth and death. Where does craving come from? What do you crave? Ice cream? Why do you crave the ice cream? Do you crave chocolate ice cream because it's got a brown color? No, you're not craving it because of that. Do you crave it because you pay money for it? No, it's the other way around. You're paying money for it because you crave it. You crave it because it produces a pleasant experience, right? This pleasant experience goes by the name of Vedana in Pali. As I said earlier, Vedana could be translated by valence, but that's not really a well-known English word. Vedana is your initial automatic categorization of a sensory input as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Since we don't really have a good English word corresponding to Vedana, I'm going to continue to use the Pali word and leave it untranslated. When a pleasant Vedana is produced by the taste of the ice cream, it's like, oh good, I'll have another bite, and another bite, oh, think I'll have seconds. The craving for ice cream arises due to pleasant Vedana. Sometimes, however, we crave for the absence of something if the Vedana it's producing is unpleasant. You know that person sitting next to you in the meditation hall who is breathing all loud and funny? That's producing an unpleasant Vedana? No, not the sound Vedana. It's your mind responding unpleasantly to that sound, and you're craving for him to shut up. When he finally does shut up, you're like, please stay like that. You're clinging to the quiet. The Vedana, if it's pleasant, leads to craving for and to keeping. If it's not good, it leads to craving to not have and to keep away. That keeping or keeping away is clinging, which leads to becoming, birth, and death. So the Vedana that leads to this craving, where does that Vedana come from? For example, when you are in the grocery store, there's no Vedana being experienced that is causing the craving for the ice cream. Well, maybe there's the memory of the pleasant-tasting ice cream, and although that produces a pleasant mental Vedana, that's not the actual Vedana that generates the craving. If the Vedana of the memory was good enough, you wouldn't have to actually buy the ice cream. That craving-inducing Vedana is not happening when the ice cream is in your basket. It's not happening when it's sitting on the table. It's not happening when it's in the bowl. It's not even happening when it's on the spoon. The real Vedana happens when the ice cream hits the tongue, contact. Contact is then followed by Vedana. And that Vedana, if you're not careful, will lead to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, and all the rest of the dukkha. These contacts that trigger Vedana, where do contacts come from? Well, you left your senses engaged with the environment. You've got 5 external senses, and you've got the mind, which is the 6th sense. The 5 are receiving input from the environment, and you're going to experience sense contacts whether you want them or not. You're sitting in meditation, and then somebody outside starts making noise. You didn't want that sense contact, and you can't turn it off. You can close your eyes, so you can sort of turn off that sense contact, but you can't really close your ears, or you're walking along and suddenly there's a horrible smell. You can pinch your nose, but that smell already triggered unpleasant Vedana. That's how you know the smell is unpleasant. You put something in your mouth, you expect it to taste one way, but it tastes another way, and you can't go, oh, I think I'll have it taste differently. Your senses are engaged and functioning, and they are going to be receiving these sense contacts. And your mind, well, you've probably noticed it's rather difficult to turn it off. It just seems to want to be thinking all the time. Your mind is going to be experiencing 6th sense contacts continuously. And these 6th sense contacts, thoughts, emotions, memories, they too generate Vedana. So these senses are engaged with the environment, and they're getting contacts. The contacts are producing Vedana. The Vedana, if you're not careful, lead to craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. What about these senses? They're just part of being alive. They're part of having a mind and a body. A mind and body without any senses would be senseless because you'd be dead pretty quickly. Being senseless just doesn't work. You need the senses so that you can navigate your environment and obtain the things that are necessary to sustain your mind and body. This is how you determine it's too hot, it's too cold, you're hungry, you're thirsty, don't walk into that tree. And those senses are getting sense contacts which produce Vedana, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. What about this mind and body? Well, they're dependent on you being conscious. If you have a mind and body and you're not conscious and it stays that way, it's a pretty serious condition. You're in a coma and you'll wind up dead. You have to come back to consciousness fairly regularly. It's okay for a few hours every night. In fact, it seems to be a requirement. But consciousness has to be happening on a very regular basis. Mind and body are dependent on consciousness, and the senses are dependent upon there being a mind and body for them to be embedded in. And contact, of course, is dependent upon there being senses that have those contacts. Vedana arise when contacts take place, and if you're not careful, you'll get caught up in craving, clinging, becoming, birth, and death. What about consciousness? Consciousness appears to arise as a result of the interaction of mind and body. If there's a body but no mind, there's no consciousness. We call that being dead, right? If you have a mind but no body, well, we don't have a lot of experience with that. We really don't encounter disembodied minds very often, if at all. So really, when you get right down to it, mind and body have to interact, which produces consciousness, which is necessary for mind and body to continue to interact successfully. These are interdependent. The mind and body and the consciousness are leaning on each other like two sheaves of wheat. You pull away either one of them and the other falls over as well. Having a conscious mind and body means that you've got senses that are receiving contacts and thus producing vedana. And if you're not careful, there's going to be craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, pain, sorrow, grief, lamentation, and all the rest of the dukkha. These are the links of dependent origination, paticca samuppada. What follows in Digha-Nikaya 15, after the Buddha says, "Do not say so, Ananda, by not penetrating dependent origination is how people fall into all the dukkha they're experiencing," is a teaching on dependent origination, much like what is presented above, in the so-called reverse order, starting with aging and death, and looking at what aging and death is dependent upon. Aging and death are dependent upon birth. Then what is birth dependent upon? Becoming. And then continuing by working backwards through the links. In the Samyutta Nikaya, or the connected discourses, or thematic discourses, there are books on 56 different topics, including Book 12, entitled The Connected Discourses on Origin. In that book, there are 93 suttas on dependent origination. In Sutta 65 of Book 12, the Buddha says before his awakening he was pondering, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, alas, this world has fallen into trouble, in that it is born, ages, and dies. It passes away and is reborn, yet it does not understand the escape from this dukkha headed by aging and death. When will an escape be discerned from this dukkha headed by aging and death? When what exists does aging and death come to be? By what is aging and death conditioned? Then, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition." Remember the Buddha's original question. The reason he left home was, what can we do about dukkha? So he wonders, why do we die? Or more accurately, what does death depend on? Death depends on birth, and he works backwards in time through the 10 items discussed above, discovering necessary conditions for each of them. The links of dependent origination are best studied in this reverse order, where one can much more easily see that this teaching is not so much about causation, but rather is about identifying necessary conditions. Each item is linked to a previous necessary condition for its arising. Furthermore, in Samyutta 12.65, the Buddha says, "I have discovered this path to awakening." As near as we can tell from the various sutta descriptions of the Buddha's awakening, this discovery of dependent origination was the key to his awakening. The wheel. And what is the noble method that a stream enterer has clearly seen and thoroughly penetrated with wisdom? Here the noble disciple attends closely and carefully to dependent origination itself. Samyutta Nikaya 12.41. In the previous chapter, we discussed dependent origination as having 10 links. Often, however, you find dependent origination discussed as having 12 links, with two more added at the beginning of what was discussed in the previous chapter. These additional links are ignorance and sankharas. Continuing our exploration of dependent origination in the reverse order, we left off in the previous chapter saying that consciousness arises dependent on mind and body, and that mind and body are dependent on consciousness. In the teachings that have 12 links, we find that consciousness arises dependent on sankharas. Is this a contradiction? We previously said consciousness arises dependent on mind and body, and here we're saying it arises dependent on sankharas. But actually, there's no contradiction. This just means that the arising of consciousness has multiple necessary conditions, one of which is mind and body, and another is that consciousness needs a sankhara to be conscious of. Many things have multiple necessary conditions. The light in your room has the electric plant producing electricity. the wires being intact, the light switch being on, and a functioning light bulb all as necessary conditions. As mentioned earlier, the Pali word Sankara gets translated in a number of ways depending on the context. We find formations used in a general sense along with compounded things. In the teachings on the five aggregates, the khandhas, we find it translated as intentions or as mental activity. In the context of dependent origination, we sometimes find it translated as karmic formations. It is one of the most difficult terms to translate in all of Buddhism, and also one of the most important to understand. Despite all these multiple context-driven translations of Sankara, the Buddha used a single word in all of these contexts. Better translations are concoctions or fabrications. Both of these words fit in all of the above contexts and also have the sense of not quite true, which I think is an important aspect of Sankara. It literally means making together, so it refers to anything that is constructed. Returning to consciousness arises dependent on Sankaras. This means that consciousness arises dependent on an object of consciousness, a Sankara. There is no such thing as objectless consciousness. In the suttas, consciousness always has an object. It arises dependent on an object, usually a Sankara. The one exception is consciousness of Nibbana, because Nibbana is not a Sankara, it's a Dhamma, but still an object of consciousness. The last link in the reverse order of dependent origination is that Sankaras arise dependent on ignorance. Out of ignorance, we concoct the things of the world. We are going to need a much deeper and more nuanced understanding of this most difficult term, Sankara, to see exactly what is meant by this. I'm going to defer discussing this last necessary condition link until we have quite a bit more background to work with. It will be addressed in the chapter Nibbana, as described in Udana 8. The most famous teaching of the 12 links of dependent origination is probably the Tibetan Wheel of Life. This is a big circle that's being held by Yama, the Lord of Death. Yama is a rather fearsome creature. You can see his fangs coming over the top of the circle in the 12 o'clock position. Then at 10 and 2, you see his claws. Down at 4 and 8, he's got his feet grasping the wheel, and his tail is swishing back and forth at 6 o'clock. On the circle are a number of concentric rings. In the center, the bullseye position, there are a rooster, a snake, and a pig, each biting the tail of the other. The rooster is greed, the snake is hatred, and the pig is delusion. The next concentric ring depicts various beings coming out of states of woe and coming up to nice states, and then descending again to states of woe, the wheel of samsara. The next ring is usually the biggest one, the one where the artist has the most fun, and it depicts the six realms of existence. The lowest section is the hell realms. They are depicted in ways that Dante would be proud of. All sorts of gruesome stuff, people boiled in oil, chewed by monsters, walking through forests where all the leaves are swords, the whole nine yards. Above hell is the realm of the hungry ghosts. These are beings that in their previous incarnation were very greedy, and now they have been reborn in a realm where they have giant bellies and little tiny necks, and they can never get enough. Among the lower realms is also the realm of the warring gods, the asuras. These are beings that are fighting all the time. It appears that they own a five-sided building just south of Washington, D.C. Above that, there's the animal realm, the only realm that we know directly besides our human one. The artist has fun painting deer and rabbits and birds and all the other animals. Then there's the human realm, our realm. And the artist paints people doing various things, farming, weaving, eating, sleeping, all the various ways we occupy ourselves in this realm. Finally, at the top are the various god realms. There are the 26 heavenly realms, and the devas there are all depicted in the usual ways we expect heavenly beings to be living. Eating banquets of ambrosia, sitting on clouds playing lutes rather than harps, generally enjoying themselves. But the most important ring is the outermost ring. In that ring, the 12 links of dependent origination are depicted. Up at the top, in the 1 o'clock position, is ignorance, avidya, depicted as an old blind person trying to make their way through the forest, finding it difficult to know where to go, what to do. Dependent on ignorance are sankharas. These concoctions or fabrications are things that are manufactured, created. They are made, but they also have a hint of not quite true, like he came home last night really late and he concocted some story about a flat tire. These sankharas are not quite really the deepest truth of what's going on because they're dependent on ignorance. The sankharas are depicted at 2 o'clock as a potter sitting at a wheel making pots. Some of the pots are very beautiful. Some are misshapen. Some are broken. So too are our creations. Sankharas, in the context of dependent origination, is often translated as karmic formations, and it does include our karmic intentions, some of which are good and some of which are broken and messed up. But sankharas in dependent origination are really more than just karmic intentions. This word is referring to all the things of creation and is specifically implying that all these manufactured things are not quite the whole story since they arise out of ignorance. Dependent upon sankharas is consciousness, vijnana. Our consciousness is dependent upon there being an object of consciousness, and these objects are concoctions, fabrications, created things. These objects can be mental states or stories we are telling ourselves, or they can be physical things, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, textures, all of which are part of creation. Consciousness is depicted at 3 o'clock as a monkey swinging through the trees, grabbing first one limb, then the next. You might have encountered this monkey mind at some point in the recent past. At 4 o'clock, there's mind and body, namarupa. This is depicted as two people in a boat. One is standing up and pulling the boat along. One is lying prone and is just along for the ride. One of them is mind, one of them is body. Which is which? This is actually an important insight to gain. It's the first of the 16 insight knowledges, the delineation of mind and body. It is essential to understand what is mind and what is body, how they interact, and most importantly, which one is in charge. This is a topic to contemplate. Get yourself concentrated and then investigate your mind and investigate your body. See how they interact and figure out who's in charge. Who's deciding which way the boat goes? The answer is left as an exercise for the reader. Dependent on mind and body are the six senses, salayatana. This is depicted at 5 o'clock as a house with five windows and a door, the five external senses and the door representing the mind. Depending on the senses, contact arises, pasa. Contact is depicted at 6 o'clock as a couple embracing. Dependent upon contact is vedana. Vedana is depicted at 7 o'clock as a man having arrows shot into his eyes. Unpleasant vedana. Dependent upon vedana is craving, tanha. Craving is shown at 8 o'clock as an enormously overweight person sitting at a table that's laden with lots of food. Dependent upon craving is clinging, upadana. Clinging is depicted at 9 o'clock as someone picking fruit and putting it into baskets that are so full that the new fruit simply rolls off onto the ground. Dependent upon clinging is becoming, bhava, and that's depicted as a pregnant woman. Dependent upon becoming is birth, that's at 11 o'clock, jati, that's a mother with an infant. And then dependent upon birth is death, marana, and that's depicted as a corpse at 12 o'clock. Now we've come full circle. What exactly is going on here? Does ignorance arise dependent upon death as the circle continues? What do all the items and links actually mean? Why does birth come as the 11th item? Birth usually comes first? And the connections between craving, clinging, and becoming don't seem at all clear. And what's this deal about the things of creation arising due to ignorance? Weren't a lot of the things of creation here before anyone shows up to be ignorant? Is there a big picture? It's certainly not obvious what is going on. After all, Caroline Reese Davids did call dependent origination a mysterious old rune. What we'll do in the next few chapters is take a look at the more common interpretations of the links of dependent origination. Three lives. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. Majjhima Nikaya 28.28. There are actually a number of interpretations of dependent origination, and the one presented in the Visuddhimagga in chapter 17 is probably the most well-known. This is the so-called Three Lives model of dependent origination. These 12 links are said to cover three lifetimes. The first lifetime is your previous life and consists of ignorance and sankharas, which are interpreted as karmic formations. So, in your previous life, out of ignorance, you acted in certain ways, and these actions, or your karma, have results which give rise to this current life. This life consists of consciousness, mind and body, six senses, contacts, vedana, cravings, and clingings. Then your next life consists of becoming, birth, and death. This traditional interpretation is standard Theravadin orthodoxy and has its roots in either the Pratisambhidamagga or perhaps even earlier in the Abhidhamma. Basically, the Three Lives model says that in your previous life you were ignorant and thereby generated karmic formations, your ignorant actions. This has led to your rebirth in this life with a karmically generated consciousness and mind and body. Your mind and body have six senses which experience sense contacts generating vedana, and because you are not fully awake, you wind up craving and clinging. The clinging in particular is clinging to being alive, so when you die this time, that clinging will result in you coming again, becoming, to birth, and eventually another death. This interpretation is quite satisfying for those who have an immortality project. By immortality project, I'm referring to the widespread tendency of people to seek some way that, when their body dies, they won't really cease to exist. The most common manifestations of immortality projects involve rebirth in either heaven or hell, or reincarnation in either this realm of our current lives or another realm. It implies the Buddha taught that you won't cease to exist, at least not until you become fully awakened. Its most profound implication is that if you can quit craving, then there won't be any more clinging, including not clinging to life so strongly that the force of becoming results in your future birth and inevitable death. This is a way to escape samsara, the cycle of birth and death, and thereby escape all future dukkha. But there are some serious problems with the Three Lives model. The Buddha has said at Majjhima Nikaya 28.28, one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. One who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. The Dhamma is also said to be sandhittika, visible here and now, and akalika, without involving time. How on earth could one see three lifetimes here and now? Either the Dhamma is not equivalent to dependent origination, or two of the factors of the Dhamma which are chanted every day in every monastic setting, sandhittika and akalika, are wrong, or the Three Lives model is wrong. Number two, the Three Lives model, in its deeper implications, teaches that this life's consciousness, mind and body, senses, contacts, and the vedana experienced in this life are all the result of the karma from your previous life. Such a teaching should be examined in light of Samyutta Nikaya 36.21. Some vedana shivaka arise here originating from bile disorders, originating from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders, originating from an imbalance of the three, produced by change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, produced as the result of kamma, that some vedana arise here produced as the result of each of the eight causes one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when those ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what was done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. In other words, not all vedana arise from karma. Only a subset of vedana arise from karma. Other vedana arise from the other seven conditions. Also, in Samyutta Nikaya 12.25, we find someone asking if vedana are created by oneself, by others, by both oneself and others, or do vedana arise fortuitously? The answer is that pain and pleasure are dependently arisen. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. If the Three Lives model is correct, then either all vedana arise from karma, contradicting Samyutta Nikaya 36.21, or there are Vedana that are not dependently originated, contradicting Samyutta Nikaya 12.25. Number three, the three lives model logically doesn't make any sense. Frequently, the Buddha says that with the ceasing of ignorance, there is the ceasing of the sankharas, and with the ceasing of sankharas, there is the ceasing of consciousness, and so on up to, with the ceasing of birth, there is the ceasing of aging and death and all the other dukkha. So uprooting ignorance leads to the end of dukkha. But the ignorance that you need to uproot is in your previous life. How are you going to uproot the ignorance of your previous life when you can't even remember your previous life, let alone go back and change anything? There seems to be a serious problem here. I find it highly unlikely the Buddha would make such a stupid logical error. The usual move to avoid the above problem is to say all three lives are taking place simultaneously. This life is the previous life for your next life, hence ignorance and sankharas are currently present. This life is the next life for your previous life, hence becoming and birth were present and death will be present. But this makes an even greater mess. Uprooting ignorance in this life would mean that craving and clinging would not occur in your next life, and finally dukkha would not arise in the life after your next life because that life would not actually arise. But the Buddha is clearly teaching a method for ending dukkha in this life. The third noble truth is very clear, that the cessation of dukkha is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of craving. Dukkha ends here and now with the ending of the necessary condition of craving. It does not end only after death, and especially not after two more deaths. Number four, the teaching on transcendental dependent origination winds up contradicting many of the Buddha's teachings if multiple lifetimes are involved in interpreting it. We will revisit this particular contraindication for a three lives interpretation after a thorough exploration of transcendental dependent origination in a following chapter entitled Transcendental Dependent Origination. Number five, the Buddha does not ever seem to have intended such a multiple lifetime interpretation. There just are not any suttas that clearly lead to a three lives interpretation. However, Digha Nikaya 15, which we have quoted from earlier, does imply possibly a two lives interpretation. But Digha Nikaya 15 is a curious sutta. It comes from the land of the Kurus, which modern scholars have identified being the area around what is currently Delhi in India. Yet, that is a very long way from all the other places where the Buddha is said to have delivered his discourses. In fact, the distance from Savatthi, one of the westernmost places the Buddha gave other discourses, to Delhi, is further than from Savatthi to the easternmost places where the Buddha taught. And there are no places between Savatthi and Delhi where the Buddha is said to have taught or even passed through. Other features of Digha Nikaya 15 and the other suttas from the land of the Kurus seems to imply they are later compositions. Digha Nikaya 15 is curious also in that there are only 9 items given for dependent origination, starting with aging and death and working back to consciousness, but leaving out the 6 senses. It would appear to be an early list of items with a later explanation added to them. Given all of these problems with the three lives model and the fact that there really doesn't seem to be any support for that interpretation among the thousands of suttas, the three lives model does not seem to be what dependent origination is all about. Sorry, there is no support for any immortality projects here.